Whitney Media 1460 WVOX presents The Advocates with Richard Garfunkel. Provocative conversation about world issues. Now, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Hello and welcome to our program, The Advocates, on WVOX 1460 AM. My name is Richard J. Garfunkel. I'm the host of this weekly forum. This program is coming live from New Rochelle, the Queen City, located on the Long Island Sound, and can be heard live streaming worldwide on WVOX.com. One can call into WVOX at 914-636-0110, but as I say each week, please stay germane to our subject. My guest this afternoon is Professor Deborah Lipstadt, author of The Eichmann Trial, and she is an internationally recognized expert on Holocaust denial and anti-Semitic revisionist history. Welcome, Professor Lipstadt, to The Advocates, and thank you for joining me today.
Thank you, Richard. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. You know, meanwhile, as I say each week, the mission of The Advocates is to bring to the public differing views on current public policy issues. Public policy, therefore, is what we as a nation legally and traditionally follow. Professor Deborah Lipstadt is the Dorot Professor of Modern Jewish History and Holocaust Studies at Emory University. She's involved with the Tam Institute for Jewish Studies and the Department of Religion. Her new book, The Eichmann Trial, published in commemoration of the 50th anniversary of the Adolf Eichmann Trial, has been called by Publishers Weekly a penetrating and authoritative dissection of a landmark case and its after effects. Her book, History on Trial, My Day in Court with a Holocaust Denial, was the story of her libel trial in London against David Irving, who sued her for calling him a Holocaust denier and a right-wing extremist. The book won the 2006 National Jewish Book Award, and pretty amazing story, as we'll go into. She's also the author of Denying the Holocaust, The Growing Assault on Truth and Memory. It's a first full-length study of those who attempt to deny the Holocaust. She was a consultant to the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum, helped design the section on the museum dedicated to the American response to the Holocaust. She's also written Beyond Belief, The American Press and the Coming of the Holocaust. It's an examination of how American press covered the news of the persecution of a European Jewry between the years 1933 and 1945, and addresses the question, what did American public know and when did they know it? She received her Bachelor of Arts degree from City College in New York City, her MA and PhD from Brandeis University. She's frequently called on the media to comment on a variety of issues. She has received honorary doctorates from Ohio Wesleyan, John Jay College of Criminal Justice, Yeshiva University, Bar Ilan University, the Jewish Theological Seminary, and the Hebrew Union College. You know, before we get into this. You know, World War II in Europe ended 66 years ago this past May 8th. As a result of that cataclysmic event, two-thirds of European Jewry was destroyed through the concerted design and effort of Adolf Hitler and the leadership of the Nazi Party, which controlled Germany from 1933 to the end of the war. As a result of the Allied victory, Nazism was destroyed, but not all of these war criminals were brought to justice. Some were tried and convicted. Others were brought to justice in a number of European countries. Many faded into the post-war population of the divided Germany. And a number who were indicted as war criminals escaped. Professor Lipstadt, who was Adolf Eichmann? What was his role and how did he and others escape justice?
Adolf Eichmann was a lieutenant colonel in the SS. And he was not, as is often thought, the architect of the final solution. He was what I would call, nor was he the CEO, the chief executive officer. He was what I would describe as one of the primary COOs, chief operating officers of the final solution. His responsibility extended throughout Western Europe, the Netherlands, Belgium, France, Germany, parts of Italy, Greece, to organize the deportation of the Jews from those places. Probably we're talking about 1.5 million Jews, approximately, to the death camps. He rounded them up. He supervised the confiscation of their property. He tracked down individual Jews. And he made sure, as he was organizing the deportation, that the camps to which they were being sent were operating efficiently, that they were killing them in an, quote-unquote, efficient manner. He made much of what the final solution was happen, and he did so with a relatively small staff of dedicated individuals and offices in Paris, in the Netherlands, in various places throughout Europe. So he was a very critical figure in giving life or and eventually death to the idea that the Nazi officials came up with, the higher-ranking officials, higher than he, Hitler, Himmler, Heydrich, for killing the Jews.
How did he escape justice?
How did he escape justice? At the end of the war, he was picked up by the Allies, and he was in an American POW camp. And then his name, he learned his name had been given to the Allies by one of his former associates. And then that his name was mentioned at Nuremberg. Eventually, an indictment was even issued for his arrest. And at that point, he had actually escaped already from the POW camp with the help of fellow SS prisoners. He went to northern Germany, where he worked for a lumber company. And then as his name was mentioned more frequently, he decided it was prudent to get out of Europe. Mm. And with a Red Cross pass and possible and help from Vatican officials, and we don't know how high up that help went, he escaped Argentina.
Mm. You know, after Eichmann's capture by Israeli agents in Argentina, which was one of the most exciting events of that period, and I remember it quite well, and his indictment and trial in Israel, there was an intense debate about his abduction, the authority regarding his trial, and how it was conducted, and the justice meted out. Could you tell us why there was controversy regarding this international criminal?
Sure. Well, the controversy is quite clear. First of all, he was abducted from another country, and generally, you know, countries don't do that, though. If you think back on our country, we didn't abduct him, but we went in and finished off someone who was clearly an enemy of our country. So first of all, it was the abduction. Second of all, it was who was doing the abduction. Critics said the abduction was conducted by representatives of a country that didn't exist at the time of the crime. So how can they possibly take him? It's an illegal act. And B, who gives them authority to try this man? They don't have the authority. They didn't exist when the crimes were committed. Mm. So that was what the critics said. Now, the critics also said when they were asked for what should be the alternative, some of them said, you know, let him be taken to Germany. Well, of course, Germany had no interest in having anything to do with Eichmann. They didn't want Eichmann brought to that country. Chancellor Adenauer, the head of the West German government, the last thing he wanted was a trial of Eichmann because it would shed light on other former Nazis who were in his government and played important roles in his government. There was no international criminal court for this kind of crime. There was an international criminal court for hearing cases between countries, but not against an individual. Mm. The Nuremberg trials could have been reconvened, but no one wanted to do that and have the Soviets sitting in judgment. So there really was, and Argentina and many people in Argentina, many officials, the police, and it's been suggested to me by former members of the Frondizi government, to the president of Argentina at the time, that even he knew he was there, but that's unclear. But we do know that the Argentinian police knew he was there.
Mm-hmm.
Showed no interest. The only country that was interested in tracking him down, finding him, and trying him was Israel.
Right. You know, the trial created headlines all over the world. The man in the glass booth, as he was known.
Right.
You know, there was a play on Broadway. There was all sorts of coverage later. He was prosecuted by Israel's Attorney General Gideon Hausner.
Correct.
Who was Hausner, and what was his strategy, and why was he criticized?
Hausner was the Attorney General of Israel. He had been appointed Attorney General shortly before this whole case came to light. He was a political appointee. He was a commercial lawyer. He had not, you know, he was not a experienced criminal lawyer. He was a European-born Jew, Eastern European-born Jew, who had come to Israel long before the Holocaust. And he decided that he would try the case and he would conduct the case, even though many people had hoped, in Israel had hoped, that he would give it to a more accomplished prosecutor. But he really became the face of the prosecution.
And how about his strategy of doing this? Somewhat he was criticized, but in the long run, did he do a good job? That's the question.
He did a very good job. He made certain mistakes. He made a mistake in how he portrayed Eichmann. He portrayed Eichmann as the brains behind and the man behind the entire Final Solution. That wasn't the case.
Yeah.
He was at times bombastic and, a little bit peacocking, around in sort of very theatrical in the courtroom. On the other hand, he made a crucial decision for which we owe him tremendous credit. He looked at the Nuremberg trials, which had taken place, right after the war, and he said those trials failed to capture the imagination of the public at large. They just didn't do it. For a variety of reasons, they didn't capture the imagination of the public at large. In part because they happened right after the war. Mm. In part because there were over 20 defendants in the box being charged. In part because the world was really not interested. It was more interested in rebuilding and focusing on trying to rebuild and recover from this terrible war.
And you bring that out in regards to Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion and his cautiousness in regarding bringing in the issue of Germany and the issue of, as you mentioned earlier, the former Nazis that were very prominent, Adenauer's cabinet.
Right.
We have to,
Ben-Gurion, but just to finish on
Hausner. I have to go to a break. I'll be right back. We're coming up against a short financial news update. I want to remind our audience of listening to Advocates on WVOX, live streaming on WVOX.com. My guest is Professor Deborah Lipstadt. We'll be back in a moment. Thank you.
With business news at 20 minutes past the hour, every hour. Here's the latest update from the Fox Business Network on WVOX Worldwide.
From the Fox Business Network, two economic reports are pushing markets into the red today. The Federal Reserve Bank of New York's Empire State Manufacturing Survey came in negative and was especially disturbing since just 2 weeks ago we got the May ISM number, and it suggested that overall growth in manufacturing is slowing. Inflation is also coming in higher than expected, with the latest CPI number showing Americans are paying more for things like automobiles and clothing. At noon Eastern, the Dow was down roughly 140 points. But a little relief at the pump. Gas prices dropped another penny overnight. The new national average is $3.68 a gallon, according to AAA. President Barack Obama has issued an executive order setting up a government project to bring business to the United States. The Commerce Department will run the program. The effort comes as President Obama tries to emphasize job creation in the face of 9.1% unemployment. With the Fox Business Report, I'm Adam Shapiro.
This Father's Day, give Dad SEAL Team 6, the instant best-selling book about SEAL Team 6, the elite unit that got Bin Laden. The New York Times calls SEAL Team 6 adrenaline-laced, comparing it to a Tom Clancy novel. SEAL Team 6 explains how this covert combat squad is able to precisely execute missions like the Bin Laden operation. When the Navy needs the best, they send the SEALs. And when the SEALs send their best, they send SEAL Team 6. SEAL Team 6, the instant best-selling book by Howard Wasden and Stephen Templin. On sale now.
Call us crazy.
You're crazy.
But we believe radio should be delivered free of charge.
Are you crazy?
Go ahead. Listen all you want. It's free. WVOX Worldwide and WVIP HD3.
1460 WVOX.
Now, back to The Advocates with Richard Garfunkel on 1460 WVOX and WVOX.com. Join in the conversation at 914-636-0110. Once again, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Welcome back to The Advocates with my guest, Professor Deborah Lipstadt. We're discussing the Eichmann trial, her thoughts on the criticality of this event. The trial was a tremendous story and was covered by many news sources, but one person who was most remembered in that coverage was German-Jewish intellectual Hannah Arendt. It was her article in the New York magazine, New Yorker magazine, along with her subsequent book in which the phrase, The Banality of Evil, emerged. Professor Lipstadt, what did she mean by that famous description of Eichmann and his infamous cohorts?
Right. I think on that phrase, she was really misunderstood. People thought that she meant that evil, the evil that had been committed, was banal. And the truth of the matter is that it wasn't. The fact is that what she meant by that is that people can do terrible, terrible things, even if they are not terribly committed. You see, well, let me go back for a minute. She thought that Eichmann was not a committed anti-Semite, that he had just followed orders. He'd been given orders, and he carried them out. She thought he deserved to die, and he deserved the death penalty, but she didn't see him as a committed anti-Semite. And virtually all scholars today think she just got that wrong, completely wrong. Even those who subscribe to many of her other theories think that that was she got that completely wrong. So what she was saying was that even if you're not committed to this notion of anti-Semitism, you can still go ahead and do these kind of things just because you're told to. You can act out of very banal kind of reason. So I think that's what she meant on that. People have interpreted it as meaning that she thought that the killing was banal, but it really wasn't.
Right.
That's not what she meant.
You know, you've been in the forefront of challenging this assertion of Eichmann being a blindly loyal bureaucrat following orders. Mm-hmm. How do you differ with the evaluation that the German people were guilty as willing executioners, in the words of Daniel Goldhagen? Did he go too far on that? How do you think on that?
I think that there are a lot of things that Daniel Goldhagen got very right. He covered in a very intense way the degree to which so many Germans, not just the killers, not just the SS people at the camps or the Eichmanns and his crew, were involved in the killing of the Jews, how many tens of thousands, if not hundreds, had really been part of this.
Mm.
I do disagree with him, as scholars are wont to do, that this was something that could only have happened in Germany, that Germany had a unique form of eliminationist anti-Semitism. Exterminationist anti-Semitism. But the fact is that the German people were well aware of what was going on. But on some level, that's even the wrong question to ask. Because by the time the killings start, Germany is such a totalitarian state that it is terribly hard for, and terribly difficult, though some people do, for people to respond to what is happening, to fight what is happening. The question that has to be asked is, where were the German people in 33, 34, 35,
right.
36, 37, 38, you know, when before we got to the killing?
Right. In other words,
how were they facilitating this government? How many of them were sort of looking the other way or saying, okay, I don't agree with this anti-Semitism stuff, but, I'm gonna support him because of all the other good things he's going to do. He's going to make us rich. He's going to make us strong. He's going to bring us back our honor, et cetera.
Yeah. You know, I have a Professor Lipstadt. I have a caller, John Bereni. He's a longtime panelist and commentator on the Advocate program. He's an expert on the events, writings, and oral history connected with the Hungarian Holocaust. He is from Hungary. His family were victims of the Holocaust. He was an original member of the National Committee created to urge U.S. Congress to award the honorary U.S. citizenship for the Swedish diplomat Raoul Wallenberg, along with late Congressman Tom Landos. John, you have a question for Professor Lipstadt?
Yes. Hi, Professor.
Hi.
The question is...
Could you speak up, please?
On the ground in 1944, there were international diplomats that were trying to save Hungarian Jews, and to some extent they were able to accomplish a few things. And they met with Eichmann a number of times to urge him to cooperate, I suppose is the word, but it may be the wrong word. Has your research indicated why these international diplomats operating in Hungary in 1944 could not be more successful at the time?
I haven't, done deep research on that. I know things peripherally. I haven't looked at the original documents or anything because that wasn't what I was looking at. But one can imagine these international diplomats were living in a country that was being, though ostensibly was under Hungarian rule, was really being administered by Germany, that there were many, many Hungarians who were very supportive of the Nazis. In fact, after the Germans leave, the killing of the Jews goes on, and the Hungarian fascist pro-Nazi regime continues for quite a few months. So there's a limit to what they could do. It wasn't as if they could take trucks and fill up trucks and just drive them across the Hungarian border. Where would they have gone? I mean, they could have gone towards the Soviet Union, but still, there was fights. Hostilities were still going on. So, I mean, sometimes we have to put ourselves that what Wallenberg was able to do, which he did with American support and money from that was funneled to him through the Joint Distribution Committee and from other Jewish sources in the United States, Jewish people in the United States, is quite amazing. And what other diplomats were able to do is quite amazing. So I don't think we have to ask why they weren't able to do more. We have to marvel at how much they did.
Thank you, John, for your question. You know, it's interesting, and we just have a minute left before our next break, but it's very interesting how at the end of the war, and this is something that Martin Gilbert has talked about in great detail, is that the Germans, and especially Lucy Davidovits in her books, The War Against the Jews, it was national policy of the Nazi-led government to kill Jews. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, right before a break, Eichmann said at the end, in his trial and in the testimony, that he was proud of it. Isn't this remarkable?
Yes, but that's one of the distinguishing factors about the Holocaust, that this wasn't a group of rebels, or it wasn't a civil war, but this was national policy.
Right.
To do this. And in Turkey during the Armenian Genocide, it was also national policy to persecute and take actions which resulted in the deaths and the murder of countless Armenians.
It was national policy.
That is correct.
It is really remarkable. And that the proudest moment of his life that he was the engine of this.
That's right. He expressed no remorse, neither at the end of the war, nor in Argentina when he gave interviews, nor even in his jail cell in Israel.
We have to go to a break. We have to break for commercial. I want to remind our audience are listening to WVOX 1460 AM. We're live streaming, WVOX.com. My guest, Professor Deborah Lipstadt of Emory University. When we come back from the break, we're going to discuss the impact of the trial, the surge and the rise of anti-Semitism, and her views on its connection to Holocaust denial. We'll be back in a moment or so. Thank you.
And national news three times an hour. Here's the latest update from Fox News Radio on WVOX Worldwide.
Fox News Radio. I'm Ron Flatter. 10 congressmen have filed a bipartisan lawsuit to get the U.S. out of the mission against Libya.
To protect our nation from policies where any president decides to go to war unilaterally.
Ohio Democrat Dennis Kucinich. It's the latest call from Congress to be involved in the process.
House Speaker John Boehner putting the White House on notice that as of this weekend, they will be in violation of the War Powers Act if operations continue without explicit congressional approval. The White House is sending materials to Congress later today explaining its position.
Fox News Radio's Mike Makowicz at the White House. The judge says no to Casey Anthony.
The defense's motion for judgment of acquittal as the counts 1 through 7 are hereby denied.
Judge Belvin Perry in Orlando, Florida, says the prosecution rested a substantial competent case against Anthony, who's accused of killing her daughter. The defense starts questioning its witnesses tomorrow. Fox News, we report, you decide.
Here's a special message from Whitney Radio. The Broadcasters Foundation of America and Fordham University Press are making available a limited quantity of signed first edition copies of William O'Shaughnessy's brand new book, Vox Populi, The O'Shaughnessy Files. Only just now arriving in bookstores coast to coast for $35. Copies of the new Bill O'Shaughnessy book have arrived at WVOX and WVIP in Westchester. For every $35 donation to the Broadcasters Foundation of America, you'll receive a signed, personally inscribed first edition copy of Vox Populi, The O'Shaughnessy Files, character profiles and heartwarming vignettes of legendary Westchester and New York figures. Jack Newfield, Bob Grant, Ossie Davis, Wellington Mara, Robert Merrill, John Spicer, Larry King, Ned Garrity, Dr. Rich Pisano, Mario Cuomo, Harry Belafonte, and beloved townies like Bill Skolin and John Branca. A dazzling and entertaining tour of Westchester and New York, past and present. You can now pick up signed copies of the brand new Bill O'Shaughnessy Westchester History Book here at our studios in New Rochelle. It makes a great gift for anyone who loves colorful characters and enjoys politics in New York and Westchester. A limited time offer for just $35 to the Broadcasters Foundation of America. Signed copies are available now at WVOX and WVIP. One Broadcast Forum, New Rochelle. Call 914-636-1460 for directions. 636-1460. 636-1460.
Today's public affairs and issue-oriented community programs are brought to you by the Westchester Law Firm of Berman, Bavero, Fruco, and Gauss. This highly regarded regional firm handles matrimonial law and difficult family issues like separation, divorce, alimony, custody, and reconciliation, and is widely known for the caring personal interest and compassion its highly skilled attorneys bring to this most sensitive area of the law. Berman, Bavero, Fruco, and Gauss, located in the heart of downtown White Plains in the Clarence Rappelier Building at 123 Main Street. The firm is led to this day by managing partner Henry Berman, a former chairman of the family law section of the prestigious New York State Bar Association. For a confidential consultation about matrimonial matters and family law issues, you're invited to call Berman, Bavero, Fruco, and Gauss, a professional corporation of highly qualified lawyers handling matrimonial law in White Plains at 123 Main Street, 914-997-7100. The Westchester Law Firm with the statewide reputation, Berman, Bavero, Fruco, and Gauss, 914-997-7100.
Okay, class, today's lesson is on cleanliness. Raise your hands if you think Dippin' Car Wash of Mamaroneck is a great place for your valuable automobile. Ah, good, everyone is in agreement. Now tell me, what should my precious car expect when it enters the loving hands of owner Rocco Dalvito and the staff of Dippin' Car Wash? Very good, you already know that Dippin' Car Wash is famous for their wide range of car washing techniques, including my favorite, Super Polish Wash, Anti-Wax Protection Hot Wax, and their Power Shower, which effectively removes excess dirt from your automobile. Class, did you also know the famous Dippin' Car Wash offers Armor All for your tires and interior? Dippin' Car Wash is open 7 days a week in Mamaroneck at 712 Mamaroneck Avenue, or call 914-698-9515. Westchester's famous Dippin' Car Wash has the most courteous attendants who will be glad to explain the many services now available at Westchester's premier car wash.
And now with your latest up-to-date forecast, here's Steve Pelletieri's Eye on Weather, exclusively on WVOX Worldwide.
Forecast Pacific County in the vicinity for this afternoon, mostly sunny. Slight chance of an isolated shower. Highs will climb into the lower 80s. Partly cloudy tonight. Slight chance of a storm. Lows falling into the lower 60s, mostly sunny. Dry weather on Thursday. Highs topping out into the middle 80s, mostly cloudy. Thursday night, showers likely, could be a thunderstorm on Friday. Highs will range into the middle 70s. Saturday and Sunday, both days look partly to mostly sunny, into the lower 80s on Saturday. Lower 80s Sunday, with sunny skies. Looks good on Monday. Temperatures low to middle 80s. Steve Pelletieri Jr. reporting for WVOX Worldwide, WVIP HD.
It would be a pleasure to amplify your voice on WVOX Worldwide.
It's the future right now.
Call David O'Shaughnessy, 914-636-1460.
1460 WVOX.
Back to The Advocates with Richard Garfunkel on 1460 WVOX and WVOX.com. Join in the conversation at 914-636-0110. Once again, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Welcome back to The Advocates and my guest, Professor Deborah Lipstadt of Emory University. We've been talking about her new book on the 50th anniversary of the capture of the notorious Nazi executioner Adolf Eichmann, his trial in Israel, and her continuing effort to confront and expose Holocaust denial and their anti-Semitic progenitors. Professor Lipstadt, many people feel that this trial was a seminal event, not only in the history of Israel, but with the attitude of Jews towards their own self-esteem. How do you view its immediate and long-term effect?
Oh, I think it's immediate, and its long-term effect was quite profound. First of all, some small but significant things. it cemented in the mind of the public the word Holocaust as the word to be used for this tragedy. The word had appeared earlier in the English version of the Israeli Declaration of Independence, but this cemented it. Now that was the word that would be used, A. But B, it helped create or begin to foster a generation of scholars, or generations of scholars who study the Holocaust and genocide. There were some before. Raoul Hilberg had already done his work. Reitlinger's work was out. There were many who had done work, but it accelerated it. But most importantly and most significantly, and not just for Jews, not for just for Israelis, Jews worldwide, but for the world itself, it put a public face, it put a personal face, it put an individual face on the crime of genocide. Mm. People now heard and saw the victims, saw to whom it had occurred, saw the people speaking, recognized that these were not people who were in some way compromised or weak or, people who were particularly susceptible to becoming victims. They saw young men and women in their 30s and their 40s standing there, smart, capable people, talking about what had happened to them, explaining about what had happened to them, and giving the world a sense of what overwhelming odds they face. And I think that was exceptionally powerful.
Right. You know, with all the evidence regarding the Holocaust, as we all know, which includes newsreel film from inside Germany and out, personal interviews, newspaper accounts, media witnesses, trials, and the testimony of the survivors, one would think the true history of the Final Solution in the war against the Jews was indisputable. Why is there still Holocaust denial?
Well, Holocaust denial really has on some level, has nothing to do with lack of information. Holocaust denial is a form of anti-Semitism. That's what it is. Anybody who would believe that the Holocaust, the best documented genocide in history, a dubious distinction to be sure, is a fraud, is a fake, is someone who was already susceptible to believing that Jews would create these lies. Jews had the ability to create these lies, to create this hoax. So it's not like the deniers were asleep at the switch when certain pieces of information or historical details were given out and therefore failed to know what really happened. These are people who don't believe Jews can tell the truth, who think Jews are nefarious, who think Jews are evil, who think Jews are engaged in a scheme to trick the world. And if you think about it, schemes to trick the world, schemes to trick for their own advantage, is the stereotypical basis of anti-Semitic charges. You know, when you're dealing with racism or anti-Semitism or other kinds of isms, generally stereotypes are stereotypes, and if you mix up the stereotypes, it's not going to work. The stereotype about African Americans for many years has been, and I stress to your listeners, is a stereotype, nothing to do with the truth, has been quote-unquote, shiftless and lazy. The stereotype associated with Italians is that they're one way or another associated with mafioso. A more recent stereotype that some people find amusing, which I don't find amusing, associated with young, pretty blonde women students, is that they're dumb. The stereotype associated with Jews is that they are conniving and they trick and they do things to benefit themselves financially, and the small groups maneuver to harm others. So if you think about it, what the deniers are saying when they say the Jews somehow created this myth about the Holocaust never happening, they did it to enrich themselves, to get financial aid from Germany, to get themselves a state, et cetera, et cetera. Mm. It fits into that anti-Semitic stereotype. Mm. So again, going back to your basic question, it's not a matter of they don't have enough information. If we could just provide them with one or two more documents, they'd say, oh, now I see that it happened. It's that they want to believe, they're committed to believing, they're committed to fostering the belief that Jews are conniving, Jews are evil.
You know, in September of 1996, disgraced historian David Irving filed a libel suit against you and Penguin Books for publishing a British edition of your book, Denying the Holocaust. In your book, you called Irving a Holocaust denier, falsifier, and bigot, and said he had manipulated and distorted real documents. Irving claimed to have been libeled under the grounds that you had called him a Holocaust denier when, in his opinion, there was no Holocaust to deny, as well as suggestions that he had falsified evidence or deliberately misinterpreted. Could you give us some background on who Irving was and is, and what happened with this suit?
Okay, well, I wrote the book, appeared in 93, called Denying the Holocaust, The Growing Assault on Memory, on Truth and Memory. It's one of the first full-length studies of those who deny the Holocaust. And in it, I made brief reference to this man, David Irving, a writer of historical works in England, a Brit, who had been writing on World War II history for many years, a very compelling writer. But his books always seem to have a slight edge to them in that they seem to suggest that the Nazis were not so bad and the Allies were not so good. They're always looking for that way of presenting the Nazis in a better light and the Allies in a worse light, to summarize it. In 1988, David Irving took on the mantle of Holocaust denier and testified in a Canadian courtroom saying that he doesn't believe the Holocaust happened, he doesn't believe there were gas chambers, et cetera, et cetera. He's quite explicit about it, and he says this under oath in the courtroom. So I described him as such. And I also said, because of his background as a writer of historical works, that he was someone who knew the truth and bent it. In other words, he wasn't someone who was misinformed or had been sold a bill of goods. He knew what the truth was, and he consciously went about bending it. The book came out in the United States, and then the rights were bought by Penguin UK, and it came out in England. And he brought suit against me in a British courtroom because, as many of your listeners may know, in Britain, libel laws are the mirror image of American libel laws. In America, if I say you libeled me, I have to prove you libeled me. In England, if I say you libeled me, you, as the author of the words, have to prove that you did that. What you told was the truth. The burden of proof, the onus, is on the author, the creator of the words, as opposed to being on the person who charges that they were libeled.
Professor Lipsad, let's go for a break. We'll get back to what happened to David Irving after this. We have to go for a commercial break. I want to remind our audience they're listening to WVOX 1460. We're live streaming on WVOX.com with my guest, Emory University Professor David Lipsad, talking about her in situation with David Irving, the author, and Holocaust denial. We'll be back in a moment or so to get her answer on what happened to David Irving in this case.
With world and national news three times an hour, here's the latest update from Fox News Radio on WVOX Worldwide.
Fox News Radio, I'm Lillian Wu. A constitutional clash in court over using our military in clashes. The president sued for taking military action against Libya without war authorization from Congress by a bipartisan group of 10 lawmakers who insist
it is necessary to come to Congress, and that neither NATO nor the UN trumps the United States Constitution.
One of the plaintiffs, Democratic Congressman Dennis Kucinich of Ohio, the administration saying it will send Congress a defense of its Libya position. The prosecution finishes presenting its case against Casey Anthony.
Defense testimony will begin tomorrow now that a judge has thrown out Casey Anthony's lawyer's request for him to throw out the case, claiming prosecutors haven't presented a strong enough claim that she murdered her daughter Kaylee.
The court specifically finds that the state has presented substantial, competent evidence.
Judge Belvin Perry and the jury will now hear the first witness for the defense in the morning.
Fox Radio's Evan Brown, Fox News. We report, you decide.
This is Bill O'Shaughnessy. You know, I've been telling you about Mario's, the legendary Italian restaurant in the Bronx, I think, for over 25 years, I guess. Actually, Mario's has been there on Arthur Avenue in the Little Italy Belmont neighborhood now for 91 years, since 1919. You've heard countless stories from me here on the radio about Joseph and Barbara Meliucci, and before them, Mario and Mama Rose of sainted memory. I've told you I know about the warm, caring waiters and the great service, the valet parking, and how they do great parties, how nice they are to kids. I think you know all of it by now, and how it's a perfect stop in your way to and from the Bronx Zoo, the Yankees, Fordham, or Botanical Gardens. And I also expect by now you know of my enthusiasm for Mario's and my great affection for the owners. But never once, it now occurs to me, have I told you how really reasonable Mario's tabs are. I'm reminded remind you, you can get a great lunch for $12.95. I mean, a big, full, great lunch. And at night, a full four-course dinner for just $29.95. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. All the great stuff. Veal Marsala, Sorrentino, chicken scarpiello and francese, homemade lasagna, eggplant parmesan, filet of sole, fresh and salmon, all from the regular menu for under $30 for everything. Or my own favorite, I just ordered a Mario's individual pizza. It's legendary, and a salad. I got to tell you, Mario's for lunch or dinner early in the week, like Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, is one of the best dining buys today. And you know, they're such great people, which means they don't scrimp, they don't cut back with the low prices during the week. It's off Fordham Road, 718-584-1188. I know that one by heart, 718-584-1188.
We're looking for the next Mike Francesa, Michael K., Boomer and Carton, or WVOX alum John Bronstein.
WVOX and WVOX Worldwide at WVOX.com now has program time available for rising young sports broadcasters.
And you can now produce or host an hour or half hour for your own sports talk show.
Our David O'Shaughnessy has all the details about special reduced airtime costs for independent sports talk producers.
Call David now to reserve your own weekly time slot and start booking your own guests. 914-636-1460. 914-636-1460 for special prices for sports talk show hosts on WVOX and worldwide at WVOX.com.
We have ways of making you talk. Right here at 1460 WVOX and worldwide at WVOX.com.
1460 WVOX.
Now, back to The Advocates with Richard Garfunkel on 1460 WVOX and WVOX.com. Join in the conversation at 914-636-0110. Once again, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Welcome back to The Advocates and my guest, Emory University Professor Deborah Lipstadt, author of The Eichmann Trial, Authority on Holocaust Denial. As we were discussing before our last break, David Irving was generally regarded as a legitimate historian who specialized on Germany and World War II. Early on, critics started to question not only his editorial slant, but his manipulation of the facts, especially with regards to the bombing of Dresden. I had asked you before our break, what happened with the trial and what happened to Irving? In other words, what were the conclusion to the courts?
In short, the preparation for the trial took a number of years. The trial itself was about 12 weeks long. And in the course of the trial, we didn't set out to prove that the Holocaust happened. What we set out to prove was that David Irving was a liar and that he manipulated and twisted the truth. So we followed his footnotes back to the sources. And what we showed overwhelmingly to the court, the judge was just overwhelming in his condemnation of Irving in his judgment, was that every time, not once, not many, not most, but every single time David Irving cited something about the Holocaust, he either changed a date, changed a fact, put someone at a meeting, misquoted, half-quoted, always to change the meaning. So in other words, it wasn't the innocent person who's given a book by a denier who reads it and is convinced, but it's the person who takes that information and twists it and turns it. So and David Irving's arguments were the arguments used by most deniers or the deniers' arguments that he then adopted. So in the course of that trial, we really showed that all those who might think, well, there's something to the deniers, maybe there really weren't gas chambers, or maybe gas chambers are impossible, or maybe Hitler wasn't so bad or whatever, we showed that it's all a bag of lies and tricks.
Now, let me ask you a question about Irving and doing your research on him and his books. Did he start to change over the years and become more radical and extreme in his writings and views once this exposure came about?
Yes, he became even more extreme, but he was pretty extreme before. And one of the things that we found out in the course of discovery, you know, of getting when each side exchanges documents and exchanges its pertinent materials, what we saw was that early on he was making exceptionally anti-Semitic comments and racist comments. He's a flaming racist as well, or made flaming racist comments. So, but he becomes more explicit about it. I think he becomes more explicit about it. This is my assumption. When his name is, he's less and less taken seriously by scholars, and he wants. And one of the few places he can win a hearing and gain a following is amongst the deniers. They welcome him to their meetings long before he becomes an explicit Holocaust denier, because they feel they bask in his glory.
So, in other words, like a moth to a flame, as he became discredited by the trial, people, historians really looking at his work with criticality, he goes to this audience. He plays into this audience. But the question came up to me earlier, and I had read his books and have a pretty decent knowledge of him. How did he become this? Well, as a Brit, as an individual who British were victims of Hitler and the Blitz, is there any reason for this that you know?
You know, I don't know of any specific reason. You know, if let's say, this is just an example, and out of the, you know, pie-in-the-sky example. Let's say he was once hurt, tricked, whatever, by someone who happened to be a Jew. If he became an anti-Semite before that, that would be like me becoming a racist because an African-American cut me off at the light or something like that. You know, it makes no sense. There is no, when someone adopts such a nonsense view, when someone engages in such lies and distortions, there's not a rational reason for it. I don't know whether it was a matter simply of wanting publicity. He often spoke about the fact and wrote about the fact that he missed the England of his youth from the 1930s, where, you know, the people were all the same and you didn't have ethnic groups and black faces and Jews walking around as openly as they do now, et cetera, in such numbers. Or whether it was just a matter of him getting publicity, or whether at heart he always was an anti-Semite, all those things are very possible, if not likely.
Mm. You know, you have stated that there's been a decade-long rise in worldwide anti-Semitism due to the Iranian president's rhetoric, Muslim anti-Israel propaganda, and the worldwide economic meltdown and other specious lies. Do you see Holocaust denial as going hand-in-hand with anti-Semitism, or just more extreme conspiratorial thinking that is discounted by almost anybody?
Oh, I think it's absolutely, they go hand in hand. It's all part of the same, you know, medley of causes and developments. And Holocaust denial is part of it. Look, Ahmadinejad is now your most public and well-known denier, but I don't just focus on him. And I think we have to be careful about putting too much attention on him, because one day the imams will decide he should be gone and he'll be gone or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's much more, Holocaust denial is much more widespread in much of the Arab and Muslim world. And in fact, well, I have a website at an Emory University-based website, www.hdot. It stands for Holocaust Denial on Trial.org, O-R-G. It's an Emory website, but it has its own portal, its own entrance. And on there, we have a section with sort of questions and answers about Holocaust denial, which we've translated into Arabic and Farsi, because we're anxious to get positive information about Holocaust denial, explaining what it is, and we also have it in Russian and Turkish. We're going to put up other languages soon as well. To people who don't have access to this information, because what they hear mainly is denials and distortions from their leaders.
You know, we've seen the rise of the price of oil, the inability of bringing a peaceful solution to the Israeli West Bank conflict, the unrest in the Arab Muslim world all over, almost in every area. Are these events feeding the rise of anti-Semitism?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Look, they feed the rise of anti-Semitism amongst those who are already inclined to be anti-Semitic.
Mm.
I don't think the American who had no overt racism in him or her became a racist because they opposed President Obama's policies. I do think there are many people in America who were racist before, who found their racism sort of validated by their opposition to Obama's policies. If you get my drift, I mean, you've got to have it before. It doesn't come out of nothing.
Right.
It just doesn't say, you know, if you're hurt by a Jew or hurt by an African American or a Hispanic or a woman, you don't suddenly become sexist. You don't suddenly become racist. You don't suddenly become anti-Semitic. It's there. It's there in some small measure, and it gets provoked, and then you build on it.
As Rodgers and Hammerstein said, in South Pacific, you have to be taught. You know, in the closing moments, how would you regard the reception to your book, and do you have any new projects on the horizon?
The reception to my book has been overwhelming, an overwhelming surprise to me. It is a book that I wrote not just for scholars, but even more for the public at large, people who know something about the trial but don't know very much of the details, people who remember the trial but don't remember all that it was about, who wanted to be exposed to it, people who are concerned about genocide, people who are interested in trials. And it has gotten an overwhelming reaction, and I am very gratified by it. I wrote it to be readable. It's been described as a page-turner. I don't know that I thought of that when I wrote it, but I've been very, very gratified. I think this was an important moment in history, not just in terms of history of the Holocaust, but history of genocide. For the first time, the world listened as close to 100 survivors told their story in the first person singular. This is my story. This is what happened to me. It had a profound effect on Israel. It had a profound effect on Jews worldwide, and it had a profound effect on the world at large. What we will witness in the next few months or years, whatever, as Mladic is put on trial in The Hague, much of it can be traced back to changes that began at the Eichmann trial.
Yeah. Deborah, last few seconds. Anything on the horizon? Quickly, 5 seconds.
New projects? Well, they're churning, not yet taking form, but when they do, I'm happy to come back and talk about them.
All right. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Richard. It's been a delight.
Thank you very much, and continued good luck with your exceptional and critical work. Next week, I'll be hosting Bill Samuels of the Roosevelt Coalition, and we'll be discussing the critical issue of fair legislative reapportionment in New York State. If you want to hear this broadcast or any of the other archived Advocate broadcasts, you can access them on my website, advocates-wvox.com, where all the information my guests will be posted. Thank you. Have a great day. And congratulations to Professor Deborah Lipstadt on her very important book, The Eichmann Trial. Please get it and learn the real history of the era. Thank you very much. Have a good day.